Hello, my name's Rhiann. I'm one of the trustees of Greenbelt, and over the last few days I've had the privilege of speaking to various members of the Pussy Riot Collective, and I feel I have learnt so much, and I'm looking forward very much to hearing from Sasha, who is with us for the next 45 minutes or so, who is a promoter of events into Russia and promoter of people who come from Russia out to us in the West. So the way that we thought we'd do this is Sasha's going to take the floor for the first 10, 15 minutes or so and tell us a little bit about his career and what he does. Then I'll ask a few questions, and then I'll throw the floor open to you. And it's early, right? So we're going to have a nice gathered conversation together. And at the end of it, I would like to all of us to understand a little bit more about the life of the artist in Russia, the life of the ordinary person under Putin, and just to help us understand what we can do to support the work of people like Sasha and of Pussy Riot. So that sound okay? Excellent, thank you very much. I'm going to drink my tea. I'm really sorry that I'm doing this in front of you. I feel a bit guilty. And Sasha's got, not much left, but he's going to drink his as well. So thank you. Sasha, over to you.
Hello, good morning. It's actually surprising that you came that early, you know. So it's very early for us. I think it's rather good perspective, I mean, to give me an opportunity to tell you a little bit about my life. Actually, I found just now that there's very kind of informative article of myself in the most, popular oppositional newspaper called the New Gazette, Novaya Gazeta in Russia. It's just during the peak of my activity of coordinating international support for Pussy Riot in 2012. And it's interesting that, all my, kind of biography, I don't like this word, but anyway, some path which actually led me to who I am now and why I am here and why I am with this collective now here. So I just, if you allow me, I just use this as a kind of guideline, because it's a pretty good article, by the way, and I think so. I would write another article now, because many things changed during this 6 years, and I consider this rather naive right now, but we're always naive today and more wise tomorrow, right? I mean, in most of cases, with some sad exceptions. So I was born in 58, I'm 60 years old. My father was a military engineer, my mother was a teacher of history, and from my very childhood till now, unfortunately or fortunately, it's very hard for me to answer the question, where do you live? You know, I used to travel all the time, and I'm still traveling all the time. I came here with my 2 years old daughter, with my 33 years old wife. We made 4,000 kilometers by car from Montenegro through different countries of Europe here. Then, 10 days ago, my first wife came from Moscow to help us with our little daughter. And also we will visit my son in London, who is 30 years old. And then my daughter, who is 2 years old, she visited 40 countries already during her 2 years old life. And it's all my life like this. My father was, I didn't know about this, it was a secret, but my father was an engineer who served nuclear heads in missiles. That's why we were always traveling near borders of USSR. And I spent most of my time in Georgia and in Latvia. Why in Georgia? Because my father spent most of my childhood in Georgia, in different points of nuclear missiles. And my grandparents, they lived in Latvia, so I spent all summers in Latvia. That's why I knew both Georgian and Latvian language. And I didn't live in the very Russia, in the Russian Republic, before I became 17 and entered Moscow State University. And from the very childhood, I thought that I was sure that I live in the best country in the world. I liked communist ideology, and by the way, I liked it very much still, because I think it's the most human and the most kind of perfect ideology ever existed. But it didn't work, unfortunately. And step by step, I started to realize that it doesn't work. Though, I can tell you that what we really didn't have, at least in this, let's say, Brezhnev time of communism in Russia, of course it was not communism, it was so-called developed socialism. We were just looking to get to communism. There's no money, like brotherhood, like everybody had brothers and sisters, and like everybody could get whatever he wants or she wants, and everybody should give whatever she can give to society. It was like so miracle and beautiful ideas. And we didn't have any hatred. I don't remember that we had any hatred towards anybody. Yeah, we were taught that capitalism is bad, that you know, mm-hmm. communism is the only possible way of life. And we've seen like a lot of exploited workers all over the world, and exploited people of labor, and realized that this world is aggressive, imperialist, blah, blah, blah. So we really believed in this. But step by step, I just started to realize that there are a lot of hypocrisy in our own society, in Soviet Union. I realized that our political commentators just give us some specific part of truth. I realized that information what we have is in fact propaganda, and it was very early. Like I started to feel something like this from 6 or 7 years old. I just remember this very disputes with my father. My father also understood a lot of things, but he was very patriotic, so he tried to tell me that I'm exaggerating things, whatever. I didn't like military parades, for instance, at all. I didn't realize why these missiles, which have to kill people, why we have to watch them every big holiday in Russia, why we have to watch these soldiers with guns and with tanks. And I was crying. I was trying to get rid of TV, and everybody were watching these big parades, which were like demonstration of power and let's say pride of Soviet Union. So and step by step, this feeling of this is not communism, this is not whatever is written in our constitution, this is not what is written in our communist manifests, whatever, it became stronger. And when I was 20 something, I used to be the student of Moscow University. From 17 years old, I lived in Moscow. And I realized that it's so difficult, close to impossible, to visit other countries. And it was my dream to visit other countries. And once I made a report, environmental report, because I was doing my diploma in university in the field of environmental economics. And I've done a quite good report in so-called World Commission of Environment and Development, led by then Prime Minister of Norway, interesting woman, Gro Harlem Brundtland. So after this, she invited me to London, by the way, to London to participate in the final session of this World Commission on Environment and Development, and the presentation of their main document called Our Common Future. And I've got a call from Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Soviet Union, and they told me, listen, you're going to England, you're going to UK. I was so shocked, I was so happy. But then it took me like 1 month, or maybe more, to get through all these commissions, like Communist Party Commission of my faculty, my economic faculty, a lot of like Young Communist League Committee, and they all questioned me why should I go to UK, whatever. And I didn't understand. I thought that, okay, call from Ministry for Foreign Affairs, it's like, period, it's like I'm going. No, it was kind of democracy, like everybody in every level could stop you. And they thought it's like democracy, you know, like everybody could stop you from going abroad. And they were very jealous, I mean, this very kind of functionaries of our university, because I was not a member of party. I even had like nickname dissident, because very often I spoke with people about things which were not really nice to discuss in the Soviet Union. For instance, once my father was contaminated. I mean, he had some radioactive, you know, what's the English for? Exposed to radioactivity, because he was working with nuclear materials, and he was in a hospital. And I found there soldiers and officers without legs from Afghanistan. And then I realized that these officers did not only plant apple trees there, which was written in our newspapers, but they really kill people, and they are killed themselves. When I found this, I was full in tears. I came to my university and said, listen, I've seen the guys who you know, kill civilians in villages, and they are also killed, but we don't know anything about this. And people were afraid of listening to me. So, and of course, they were afraid to allow me to go to England to participate in this commission, you know. So I went through like nightmare chains of all these commissions. And finally, the Communist Party committee of my faculty, even before university, they didn't allow me to go. So it was a big shock in my life. I just realized that we are like prisoners in this 1/6 part of the world, how it's possible. And until this age, and I was like something 25 or 26, I didn't realize that it's so difficult. That was the main difference between, for instance, Soviet Union and Eastern Germany. In Eastern Germany, because they have a different mentality, Germans, very strict, very kind of, they always say the truth. It's my opinion. I work with Germans for 40 years, and they never do these things. It's in their culture. And in Eastern Germany, it was like very strict. You cannot get abroad, period. People knew this. In Soviet Union, nobody would tell you that you cannot go abroad. But when you try, you encounter with so many problems, and nobody officially tells you that you cannot. Everybody say like, okay, you have to do your thesis, you have to write your diploma, and step by step you realize that it's like a wall, which you can in principle overcome, but it's so difficult. It became a big shock for me, because I was always, you know, trying to travel to other countries, and also I organized, even in Soviet Union, I organized several environmental events, big environmental events, acting through some university organizations, and then I became a chairman of Ecological Club of Moscow University with several, it was like maximum like 3,000 members, 3,000. And then I became a chairman of Environmental Association, but it was also under Gorbachev and Perestroika. And Gorbachev, in 85, his speech in the gathering of Communist Party was like fresh air, because he said about everything we noticed before, like he said about all this lie and, you know, hypocrisy, and he said that we have to now to be vocal, glasnost, you remember this word, glasnost, perestroika, like openness, new way of thinking, and all of a sudden all gates started to open for us. It was like such an incredible thing. Maybe the most exciting time of my life, like shortage of goods, like Soviet Union before breakup, but incredible wind of freedom. Like we started to travel all over the world. I started to endlessly travel with environmental missions to America, to Germany, to even to Africa, sending my friends to like expeditions to Botswana, to Japan, anywhere. Visas was no problem. 1 minute, 3 minutes, you know, like everything became like so easy in Soviet Union, but late Soviet Union in Gorbachev time. And then together with environmental events, environmental impact assessment, you know, some simulation games, whatever, I started to do like interesting collaborations between different international artists. For instance, one of the first projects, I didn't know the word producer, but now I understand it was really good producer's work. I put together the ensemble of all the Russian original ethnic music, choir of Dmitry Pokrovsky and Paul Winter consort, which was ecological jazz of saxophonist Paul Winter imitating sounds of whales and wolves, and you know, very interesting music. And I found that in Russian tradition there are also a lot of imitative things, like imitations of wolves, imitations of like bears, and I put them together, and it was really like an incredible concert in 1986 in Moscow University, where I was a postgraduate student making my doctorate. And people were in tears. It was incredible collaboration between American and Soviet ensembles. CNN made big reports. CNN it was first year, second year of existence of CNN. And then all of a sudden we started to travel all over the world. It was considered impossible just a few years ago, and all of a sudden we've been everywhere. So then, it's a long story, but then I participated in this 91, resistance against coup, 3 days coup. I was in these barricades with my video camera. I made the film, which was then shown in many American TV stations, and I was so proud that I live in the country where like millions of people could protest against this anti-Gorbachev, anti-perestroika coup. Then Soviet Union collapsed. I wasn't happy. I think that it would lead to some inevitable nightmares, and it happened. I still think that it would be better if Soviet Union exists, but with step-by-step kind of democratization, because this sudden breakup led to a lot of nightmares, but it's another story. And but anyway, I think that we passed through the period of living in the most free country in the world. Maybe it sounds like really, really exaggerated, but I feel that I live in the most free country in the world. Not in terms of, let's say, electoral democracy. It never existed like really in Russia, in Soviet Union, and still I think doesn't exist anywhere, even in new, let's say, members of EU. It's not that kind of perfect democracy there. But in terms of artistic freedom and in terms of freedom of speech, I never have seen any other countries with such a spectrum of opportunities where you can say whatever you want, you can do any action you want, you can do any artistic thing you want. And even with my environmental actions, we've done so many really hard kind of extreme environmental actions with a lot of art. Nobody was not even arrested and even detained, and like, you know, and many artists who did something really kind of shocking in Russia, in Red Square and anywhere, were arrested and deported from free countries like Holland or Switzerland, especially United States, because you cannot be naked in street, you cannot do this, you cannot do this. And in Russia, all of a sudden, everything which was forbidden became kind of okay, you know? But when Putin came to power, of course, Chechen War was a big shock for me. And then Putin came to power. From the very beginning, I didn't like this man, though most of so-called liberals today, who are now critics of Putin, they were supporting him because they didn't trust the Russian people, that Russian people could elect proper leaders. So they decided to put like this guy to like be like transitional kind of semi-dictator, democratic dictator, like not allowing people to vote for communists or for fascists or nationalists. And finally we came to where we are now. Step by step, free press was attacked. All main TV channels have been in fact privatized by Kremlin. And sooner or later I became a participant of protest movement. And at the same time, it's interesting that at the same time I've got best opportunities from the state, because during this Medvedev rule, when Medvedev was a president, though in a big scale he was a puppet president, but for like culture, for like freedom of speech, a lot of things changed to the better direction. So many people believe that this is like transition from Putin to like real democracy. And during this time, I was getting like really millions of, let's say, pounds from the government for big festivals. I've done many big festivals as a producer and artistic director, inviting all artists from all over the world, connecting like very big artists, very known artists, like, for instance, Patti Smith or John Fogerty or Faith No More, like many, many artists of this level, with the folk artists from remote corners of ex-USSR, like doing some unusual collaborations. And I think we've done several incredible projects. And I was a director of WOMAD, if you know this festival of Peter Gabriel. I know Peter Gabriel very well, so he trusted me to be like the director and producer of WOMAD in Russia, only one, in 2013. So, and then when Pussy Riot case happened, I didn't know about them before. I liked very much their Red Square action. I cannot say that I liked their church action. I thought it's brave. I thought it's really, it really touches very important topic, like the beginning of the union of Putin's Kremlin and the Orthodox Church, trying to use Orthodox Church as a sacral foundation for Putin's power, like replacement of Communist Party, because for several years we didn't have any ideology. And they just decided to get back this Orthodox Church as a kind of main ideology of New Russia. So I understood it's a very important topic, but I couldn't say that I liked the form in which they expressed this. But when they were arrested, I was shocked by the court, because it was against the law, absolutely against the law, the court, because according to the legislation that we had in 2012, the girls deserved, like, okay, maybe maximum 10 days of community service, or maybe even detention, but administrative detention. It's not a jail and it's not a prison. It's like rather easy, like, yeah, I'm in kind of jail, but it's administrative, and it's like you can, sometimes you even can call, you know, whatever. But they didn't deserve any prison term, because they did something which was okay. Maximum, it could be qualified as, say, what's the English for blasphemy, like insulting religious feelings, you know. And for insulting religious feelings, the maximum punishment in Russia was 10 days of like community service, you know, like, I don't know, cleaning the church. Or maybe in the worst case, detention. The same thing, cleaning something, but being like isolated in some special, not prison, not jail, but special detention centers for like drunk drivers or something like this. And all of a sudden, they were facing like up to 5 years of prison. And when I realized this, I just realized that I have to act. And also, I was approached by husband of Nadia, who spent 2 years in prison, almost 2 years, Peter Verzilov. Probably you've seen this guy if you've seen this report about World Cup action, this guy in police uniform with three girls who went to field. So he is the husband of Nadia, so he told me, listen, you are the only one who can help us because you know so many stars. And this was like second wave of information, because first wave was when they made this action and were arrested. And second wave was in many ways organized by me, because Peter asked me many times about this. I had some doubts. It was not fear, but some doubts, should I do it or not? But finally, I thought, okay, I'm probably the only one who can do it. So, and then I involved a lot of my friends. First was Peter Gabriel, who wrote like really passionate letter to the girls, and I was filming this. Then Peter made his statement with his iPhone, then I made two times his statements with my iPhone or video camera, and then many other people. Patti Smith sent me a very passionate letter for the girls, even Johnny Rotten, whom I presented as a leader of Public Image Limited, and the whole band are very good friends of mine, and a lot of really big stars, Sting, for instance. But I never wrote to Paul McCartney, but you should understand that in Russia, Paul McCartney, is bigger than all presidents, all artists, all together. So one Paul McCartney is much bigger in terms of authority than all famous people all together. It just happened that all that his songs are so popular, and he's still the last really kind of alive person from the leading Beatles, like John Lennon, Paul McCartney. They were the most popular, and also I can say that his shows were really great. All even the last years, he played in Red Square, and Putin was his personal guide on Kremlin. He spent several hours with him, showing him Kremlin, and everybody loves him in Russia, including Putin, and left, right, like everybody. Paul McCartney is a big authority. So I realized that Paul McCartney maybe is the most important, but everybody told me, including many English stars, don't try Paul McCartney. He's like, he can protect animals. He's a friend of presidents, but he would never do it. But in 2 days before the court, I wrote to him. I met him once. I was not his presenter, never. I wrote to him through his press secretary, very nice guy, by the way, very nice. I knew him quite well. And Paul McCartney answered in 1 hour with like incredible text. I published this text in my Facebook. Next day it was published in Paul McCartney's main page of his website. And in 1 year, when the girls were seeking for like parole release, he wrote handwritten letters to particular judges. And I brought these letters to courts. And the court, by Russian law, they have to read these statements. And then I met Masha. I visited her in prison many times. It was rather easy, and I think it's a very good norm in Russian prison that if you're a member of human rights organization, and I especially became a member of registered human rights organization, and showing this paper, I was able to get to this prison and to spend 4 hours with her without any surveillance, like just a separate room. It's the same right as a lawyer's right. And if you are a member of a human rights organization, you can visit the prisoner, but only with the agreement with the prison administration. But they always gave me this permission, so I always could visit Masha. And I visited Nadia once. I was driving there about 10 hours one way to Mordovia. And Masha was like 2 hours flight and then 2 hours drive in the Urals. But I was doing a lot of festivals in this area, so I was like going back and forth from Masha prison to my festival, from my festival to Masha's prison, and that's how we became friends. I brought them letters from Paul McCartney, from Peter Gabriel, from many famous people. Then when they were released, we met in the first day of their release. Then we started to travel all over the world. I introduced them to many world leaders, like Prime Minister of Norway, again a woman, but not Gro Harlem Brundtland, but a new one. I forgot her name, but we met her in Bergen in Norway. We visited a lot of Norwegian prisons, which are the best in the world for sure. We visited many prisons in Denmark, for instance, as well. We participated in many festivals, but step by step I realized that I want to do something creative, because step by step I lost my opportunities in Russia. Not immediately, by the way. A lot of governmental people supported me. They supported my struggle for Pussy Riot, by the way. A lot of top governmental people. But this was still a time when the very reactionary wave didn't start yet. Putin was already like very confident, like, okay, president, leader of Russia, and the time was not that tough as now. You could be like open and very powerful, let's say, supporter of Pussy Riot. At the same time, you can get governmental unbelievable money to do like huge festivals, which I think were one of the best in the world, without, as we Russians say, fake modesty, you know. But step by step, the situation started to change, and press secretary of Putin, Peskov, personally called to some local authorities, not only local, but vice prime ministers who supported me, and with very explicit language say, stop this, you know, this guy provoked people like Paul McCartney to like make statements like, you know, this is the festival of Peter Gabriel. And Peter Gabriel, read the interview of this fucking Chaparukhin, you know, he said that Peter Gabriel like wrote a song and dedicated this song to four victims of Russian, you know, rule of last years, like Litvinenko, Politkovskaya, Estimirova, and Magnitsky. You know, he really dedicated one song to them. Why do you do this festival, which is Peter Gabriel's festival, and ruled by this Chaparukhin, who is provoking a lot of famous people in the world to be like anti-Russian. And even the governmental officials, they have been shocked. They said, Sasha, we apologize, but you know what they're doing. And finally, sometimes they were saving our festivals, but this festival was like the last. After these calls, you know, I realized that step by step. And now it was my idea to do this show for Masha, because now they do separate projects, Nadia and Masha, but they are not the only Pussy Riot members. They may be the most recognizable Pussy Riot members, but they were never musicians, because it was a big protest collective, several musicians, several activists, people who wrote some, you know, verses, people who did actions. It was much broader than punk band. People thought it was punk band. No, it was kind of fake punk band in the surface. A lot of people participated in like making recordings, but they never participated in actions and vice versa. But Masha was the most powerful during her prison term. She was the most powerful. She won 3 cases out of 4 against prison administration. So, and then I realized that she writes very well. In 2014, in a literature festival in Lillehammer in Norway, they asked her to write a text. She wrote a text and like 15-minute speech with some theatralization. And I liked it very much. And so since this time, I tried to convince her, let's do something which you've seen yesterday. Have you seen yesterday our show? Yeah. But we should find the proper text. And she refused. She said, no, we don't have proper text. I don't like this idea. Like I told her, you as a woman who like is in the front, who tells you people your story, musicians, and a historical video, like, you know, insider video. But all of a sudden, after like, I spoke to her 1,000 times, I don't exaggerate, 1,000 times, because we were traveling together a lot of talks. We showed several films about Pussy Riot and about Russia with like meetings with university students all over the United States and Europe, but mostly United States. And all of a sudden she told me from Australia, where she was with the Belarus Free Theater. And it's important because she had already this experience in theater. She called me and said, listen, yes, let's do it. But now I have my book. So we've done this very show you've seen yesterday. We called it Revolution because the book was not published yet. We started the first tour in March 2017. And then through Joe Boyd, my friend, who was the first producer of Pink Floyd, very interesting producer and author of White Bicycle, book about music of 60s, wonderful person, he found a very good literary agent and publishers for Masha. And then when we published the book in Penguin Books and then in Metropolitan Books in USA, she was absolutely shocked. She couldn't believe that this might could be published. And of course, the publishing of book helped to develop our project, you know. So first was the project and then the book, you know. And then the project was changing. We made it shorter. We made the musical part a little bit more. The percentage of music became higher, and the percentage of narration became smaller. So first we were editing this text together with Masha, just two of us. And then Kirill, you remember this guy from Belarus Free Theater, he made also very, very strong contribution to change the text. And Yuri Muravitsky, he is a very good theater director, so without any like special tricks or decorations or whatever, he helped them to put it together in a really kind of impressive way. I invited him because I know that he's good in this kind of things. He's done two not similar, but like theater pieces with a lot of music, with a lot of personal things, and before. So that's why I knew that he would be the best guy to do the stage direction of this show. That's what you've seen, whatever you've seen yesterday. That's my story, more or less, you know. But now I think I spoke more than 20 minutes, probably. Yeah. Whatever. Questions?
Thank you, Sasha. And it was a really good morning for me that you spoke for 20 minutes. That even doesn't make sense as a sentence.
30, probably. 30.
Was it 30?
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. So I have got some questions for you. And we've seen riot days here, and we've heard some fantastic stories from Masha. What do you think the authorities in Russia think of riot days and this current tour and the impact that it's having?
I don't think that authorities in Russia think about riot days at all. So far, we don't have any signs that they know about this and they think anything about this. Trying to be short, Russia right now is not a totalitarian state. We have no. I think that UK and US are much more systematic. You are under surveillance here and in US much more than in Russia. Yeah, I'm serious. In Russia, it's more like mafia society. If you are really pain in the ass, if you really are dangerous for some really, tough, important official or like inner Putin circle, they can put you to prison. They even can kill you. It's my opinion. But they only notice those people who really make them angry. And there is no yet systematic like control. Or these guys are doing something wrong. It's getting more and more systematic. It's getting more and more severe. Laws are becoming more and more severe. But so far, we don't feel this kind of system. For instance, I cannot imagine that we could smuggle Masha five times for the last several months to different countries using unprotected border with Belarus, and Belarus has no common database with Russia. She's not allowed to leave Russia because of her community service for her protest actions, but we did it several times. And now she tried to fly from Moscow airport. She was stopped, and then I told her, go to Vilnius by car. She went to Vilnius by car. So if authorities would be that kind of, controlling, they would stop her. She didn't... sneak through the forest or a river. She just passed official border control points, but she couldn't fly from airports because only in airports they had this kind of message in their computer that this person should not be allowed. So why they were arrested and put to prison as an example in 2012, they wanted to show everybody, don't do this. They were very important for them because it was a very loud case, very loud. And they wanted to punish them to show everybody, don't do this. Because before, everybody did something like this, not in churches, but any protest actions. And finally, Putin and his surrounding, they became angry. When first wave of protest happened in 2011, Putin even once called these people the best part of the society. Look, this is Putin youth. You told me that it's no freedom. Look at these people in the streets. They protest against me. But step by step, they've seen the growing movement. And when Pussy Riot made the action, they say, oh, it's too much. And from this very moment, they started to be much more reactionary, much more aggressive, step by step. Again, new laws. Like now you can get to prison for like Facebook posts. So whatever was illegal in 2012, this very verdict, 2 years in prison for Pussy Riot, now it's legal. Now you can get to prison without any tricks, because it was a tricky thing to convince Pussy Riot and to give them the condemn them, right? And motivation of religious hatred. Yeah. It was no religious hatred. But now, even without any religious hatred, you can get to prison, But right now, even after this World Cup action, which was kind of loud, I do not think that Pussy Riot is a real problem for authorities, because they are not popular in Russia, it's for sure. The only popular thing that they really created is Mediazona. It's their media, which is very powerful, but it's not associated anymore with them. They were founders. They brought a lot of money, which they got from a lot of charity events, especially in 2014. But now the chief editor is the only guy who can rule, and that's very good. They never intervene. They never say to him what to do. It's a very strong and powerful media. But somehow nobody attacks this media, though they do very noble and brave work, and sometimes they're attacked by local authorities, for instance in Chechnya, but as the entity, they are okay so far. They do their very, very investigative and strong work. And this is like the most noticeable part of whatever Pussy Riot initially created, the Media Zona activity. But what Pussy Riot are doing in creative way, I don't think even that they know about this. Otherwise, after World Cup, Russian propaganda all of a sudden recalled that Pussy Riot exists and made like 20 minutes stupid kind of anti-Pussy Riot broadcast. So it shows that they paid attention on this. One broadcast, but then again nothing, you know. So I think that, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, it's not that important for them. Masha tries to do some actions now, and she's got some community service, maybe like several hours detention once, one night detention, but no any severe punishments anymore, you know. And even, as I say, for several months, we managed to somehow illegally get her to Western countries. And as we think, it's not criminal in Russia. If you even with the official ban, if you cross the borders, but with official passport and without like any tricks, it's an administrative violation, but it's not yet a crime.
I just wanted to pick something up. For us trying to get at some sort of truth, which seems increasingly difficult, no matter where you live, the Media Zona, is that a website that we can access here in the UK?
Media Zona?
Yeah.
Of course, you can, and I think, I don't know, but they have, I think that even they even have English version, but I'm not sure, but it's called Zona, Zona point media.
Okay.
That's it. And it's a very, very good and strong media.
I was very interested in the last year or so. I read about Putin appointing somebody, I can't remember his name, forgive me, but his job was to choreograph stories which created unease and a feeling of impending chaos, and sow these stories so that the Russian people turned to Putin for security. Do you know about him?
Once again, about whom?
A man who Putin had appointed to sow stories that were deliberately untruthful to create a sense of unease so that the Russian people would turn towards Putin for security.
I don't know whom.
Yeah, I wondered whether I was wondering if it was a truthful story.
No, it's hard
to ask the questions.
Let me tell you, we had a state information agency called ITAR TASS and RIA Novosti, and RIA Novosti was surprisingly good in terms of like shockingly, even during this protest wave and elections of Putin, they gave truth to Russian people, and it's a state kind of propaganda agency. And then Putin, Kremlin, they just stopped this agency from working. It was like very, very old agency, like, I don't know, 30 years, 40 years maybe, from Soviet Union. They changed the whole leadership. And now they turned all governmental agencies and TV, especially their political part, like pure propaganda. It wasn't like this before. They were like some propagandist personalities, really absolutely pro-Kremlin propagandist, but some others, sometimes in the same channel, very liberal, oppositional, but not anymore. So now they kind of privatized all media, and especially they pay attention on governmental media. So governmental media all became really propagandist. And there are several people like this you're talking about. There are several key propagandists who are like incredibly influential. They're very professional. They are all ex-liberals, like pro-America, pro-like democracy, blah blah blah. But now they get incredible money, a lot of millions a year as a salary, and they became like leaders of this kind of propaganda. The main leader probably is Dmitry Kisilev, who is the chief of Russia Today. And Russia Today is not just the TV Russia Today, but it's the corporation which includes RIA Novosti, this it's like Russian Reuters or, you know, the press agency. But all these things now are under the same roof. And maybe you mean Dmitry Kisilev, who is the main propagandist. But also there's Vladimir Solovyov, and there's Leontief, and other like more small time. But there like a lot of these people, a lot. And by the way, it's what didn't exist in Soviet Union, because in Soviet Union, at least we had like constitution which said that leading force of the society is Communist Party. So all these people who were talking with us from TV about like nightmares of capitalism, they believed in this and they were knowledgeable and kind of intelligent people. Now we encounter with a new type of people, which I am 60, I never met in my life. They're absolutely cynical. They can create any like fake things. They can like be so passionate in their kind of cynical work because it's combination of like feeling power and incredible money. They are really spoiled by really, really big money. So it's like the whole propagandist network. It's not just one. It's not just one guy. I don't know about one guy. Mm-hmm. I know that there is an organization which creates fake news on the internet, and there are people who are really working there, like trolls. You know, like people who poison internet with whatever is necessary. You know, to I don't know, but people even know the place where they are located. Olgino, one area in Moscow where this internet facility is created. It's like kind of big software kind of company. They do all this stuff. People know about this. There are a lot of them.
Because it seems to me there are two points where the UK starts to take an interest in Russia. I mean, generally, the papers on our websites. One is when we see pictures of Putin and, you know, bare-chested wrestling polar bears. The story of the mythology around him, that's the one point where we go, well, that's interesting. Because it's easier for us to engage with a character, one story. And then the other thing is interference in our democratic processes. And it's a weird thing where we're sort of vaguely impressed by Putin, but deeply worried. And we haven't got a clue what to do about interference on such a massive scale in the area of fake stories influencing our democratic processes. I don't know what my question is there. I suppose those are our two points of engagement, and there doesn't seem to be much else coming through to us about life in Russia.
But it's rather a difficult question, because you see...
It wasn't really a very good question.
It's difficult because I tend to speak a lot. Then it would be like a very long story. But regarding, let's say, mystical figure of Putin, from the very beginning when he arrived in the late 90s, to be honest, I had this kind of conspirology theory that probably kind Putin or people from ex-KGB in general, they somehow blackmailed Yeltsin and his surrounding. But I know a lot of people who are around Yeltsin, and some of them are my personal friends from my childhood, you know. And so only now, of course, I couldn't speak with them when they put Putin to power. But now I know exactly how it happened. And I know it better than most of other people, because I spoke with people who brought Putin to power. So their incentive was like to protect Russia from elections, because they thought elections are dangerous for Russia, because definitely communists had like, 70-80% of rating. Yeltsin had like 3% of rating. Believe me, I know these people, their goals were not just to protect their billions, you know, as many people think in Russia and maybe in the West. Their goal also was to protect democracy as they understood democracy. So let's not allow fascists and communists to get to power. Let's temporarily have a person who like can somehow control this. And they have chosen Putin. Liberals have chosen Putin, not like hardliners, but I know concrete liberals who were reformers in Russia. They decided to choose Putin, to use Putin as a kind of, bastion, like protection against fascists and communists coming to power. But this is very contradictory story, because this is a story how people didn't want people to vote, to elect. They were afraid that they would elect some evil people. And Putin was very loyal, and Putin was, as they told me, very democratic. For instance, they told about one story that when Putin came to one of my friends, who was a big boss, and asking him, listen, I'm asked as the KGB chief, to FSB chief, to put some bugs to the office of Yavlinsky. Yavlinsky was the main chief economic advisor, very famous. And Putin says, I asked why. And Prime Minister Primakov told me, because he's an agent of CIA. And then Putin told, if it's an idea of Yeltsin, or your idea of like Yeltsin's administration, fire me right away. If it's an idea of Primakov, I don't want to work with this guy anymore, because how should we get back to this terrible times when we could put bugs anywhere? I don't do it, you know, I cannot do it, because I am like for new society, for democracy. And they were like, oh, KGB guy says these things. And he's young, and he's like so kind of healthy, and we should step by step lead him to replace father. They called him father, and Father Yeltsin was already quite sick. He was not such an alcoholic. I knew him personally, and I spent like quite a lot of time with him. I made some interviews with Yeltsin. I spent time with him traveling in the train from Moscow to Riga. Then I met him one more time with very long conversation interview. He was a very genuine man. Rather clever, by the way. Yeah, I think that later he's got some. I don't think was it real alcoholism or it was just like drinking from time to time. But he passed through 3 strokes and 2 heart attacks. I cannot say that I'm absolutely correct in these numbers, but several strokes, several heart attacks. Of course, he lost intellectual abilities to be the leader of the country, and that's why his daughter, her husband, and some really liberal surrounding of them, they decided that they have to choose somebody who will protect Russia from danger of communism and fascism. And how to live in Russia, I still live everywhere, you know, and sometimes in Russia, in Moscow, in Perm, Urals, from where is my wife. And I feel uncomfortable now with this kind of new situation, new political climate. But I've been in World Cup recently, and I was for boycott of World Cup. But when I've seen this real celebration of friendship and like very friendly police all over the country, finally I thought it was very, very good for Russia. And by the way, Pussy Riot people who made this action, they liked championship. Mm. They liked championship. And why I like the action, because I think that with all this unity, nice unity of Russian people, you know, like no aggression, no even one fight during this championship. Very, very good atmosphere, incredible organization. Moscow is really, really well organized and beautiful city right now. And everything functions very well. That's why, by the way, it's not that easy to find more arguments why people should change Putin, because a lot of things change to better direction. Mm. Bureaucracy in Russia, at least in Moscow, I think one of the best in the world. It's 5 minutes, everything, taxes, passports, whatever. Very efficient right now, very. And it was a nightmare before. So a lot of things improved. But at the same time, you see the propaganda channels try to, Putin, world championship, whatever Pussy Riot did, they just made this very kind of pathos of like, you know, making Putin and the government sacred because of this wonderful championship. They just diminished this level of pro-Kremlin kind of spirit. They made something which was carnival which was jolly, and at the same time reminding people that we have political prisoners, and we have not only this very nice police which was in the streets of Moscow and other World Cup cities, but we also have police people who torture people in prisons. We have police people who arrest them for nothing. I think it was very good action, but it was action which is heavily criticized by both governmental propaganda and, let's say, most radical anti-Putin people, because they think that this kind of carnival stuff is like, you know, fake, and the whole championship is like should be prohibited, boycotted. But it's another thing. I think this is like a really dead end if the boycott of Russia is a very dead end thing, because then if Russia would be boycotted, more and more people would be anti-Western. Anti-Western mood became really, really strong. The strongest in my life, much, much stronger than in Soviet Union. In Soviet Union, we all understood that all this propaganda telling us like not really truthful things about Western. People were very pro-Western. Now, a lot of people are very anti-Western, and not only because of Putin's propaganda, but because of a lot of terrible mistake in Western politics, like isolation of Russia, terrible visa politics, insulting. UK is the worst country in the world in terms of visa behavior. Insulting explanations like young girls cannot get here, we have to struggle, we have to pay like £1,000 to get like Pussy Riot members from the third time here. Insulting questions, no interviews, just pay money, get refusal, pay money, get refusal, pay money, get okay, visa. Spend several months in these insulting things. Many people, they say, no more UK. We boycott UK. We don't want to go to this terrible country anymore. And you should do something with them. One of our most active members was not allowed just because she met her English boyfriend. It's suspicious. No, English boyfriend, bye-bye. With some very, very sly explanations like, okay, we don't know details of your personal and professional relations with your new sponsor. That's why we're satisfied that you don't meet, period. Mm. So I think that the main, the approach would be like more cultural exchange, more communication with the, like, let's say, simple people. And that's why World Cup helped a lot to make the climate in Russia better.
And I really don't like to interrupt you. You can spot that. Sorry. I'm just worried that I'm going to get a stern look. How long have we got left?
1 minute is all you got.
1 minute.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault. I've enjoyed Sasha's stories, and sometimes I think that's the best way is to let you speak and let us listen. I think I need to apologise because I think I did promise some questions, and I think that's now impossible. But I'm looking for some affirmation and some smiles that you have spent I've spent a fascinating hour in your company, Sasha, and I want to say.
I'm sorry, I didn't know it's so short. I thought that we still have.
No, it's fine. In my minute, thank you from Greenbelt for spending so long with us and for helping us understand so much more about the nature of protest and the nature of artistic endeavour in Russia. I think we have learned that we can go to Media Zona for something that feels like an authentic story. We've learned throughout the festival, we've heard stories about visa issues for other artists as well. There was one artist from Gaza who wasn't able to come here. So that's another thing that we maybe turn our attention to as Greenbelt. But thank you very much on behalf of the festival
thank
to you.
You
and to Pussy Riot.